tempting to pay thee a compliment, while, as thy friend, lamenting the end thy roosterishness will surely bring thee to. Whether thy companions are whores or not, and whether thee pays for their company, is irrelevant to the matter.
William began in indignation, but choked the word off before he could be further accused of repetition. I don't bloody pay them.
Irrelevant, she repeated.
Doing it herself, by God.
Thee has behaved in exactly the same way on my own behalf, after all.
You...
He stopped abruptly.
I have.
She exhaled strongly, eyeing him in a manner suggesting that she would have kicked him in the shins or stamped on his toes if not reminded of her Quaker principles. Twice, she said, elaborately polite. The occasions were so negligible, I suppose. Or I was, that he has forgotten.
Remind me, he said dryly, and ripping a chunk from the torn lining of his coat, used it to wipe the mud and blood, he saw, from his face. She snorted briefly, but obliged.
Does he not recall the odious creature who attacked us in that dreadful place on the road in New York?
Oh, that.
His belly clenched in recollection.
I didn't exactly do it on your account, nor did I have much choice in the matter. He bloody tried to cave my head in with an axe.
I think thee has some fatal attraction for axe-wielding maniacs, she said, frowning at him. That Mr. Bug actually did hit thee in the head with an axe. But when thee killed him later, it was to protect Ian and me from a similar fate, was it not?
Oh, indeed, he said a little crossly. How do you know it wasn't just revenge for his attacking me?
Thee may be a rooster, but thee is not a vengeful rooster, she said reprovingly. She pulled a kerchief from her pocket and blotted her face, which was growing shiny with perspiration again. Should we not look for thy companions?
We should, he said, with a degree of resignation, and turned toward the grove. I think they'll run if I go in after them, though.
Rachel made an impatient noise, and pushing past him, stomped into the woods, rustling through the brush like a hungry bear. The thought made him grin, but a sudden yelp wiped the smile off his face. He started after her, but she was already backing out, yanking Jane by one arm, meanwhile trying to avoid the wild swipes Jane was making with her free hand, fingers clawed and slashing toward Rachel's face. "Stop that!" William said sharply, and stepping forward, grabbed Jane by the shoulder and jerked her out of Rachel's grasp. She turned blindly on him, but he had longer arms than Rachel and could easily hold her at bay. "Will you quit that?" he said crossly. "No one's going to hurt you. Not now." She did stop, though she looked back and forth between him and Rachel like a cornered animal, panting and the whites of her eyes showing. "He's right," Rachel said, edging cautiously toward her. "Thee is quite safe now. What is thy name, friend?"
"She's called Jane," William said, gradually loosing his hold, ready to grab her again if she bolted. "I don't know her surname."
She didn't bolt, but didn't speak either. Her dress was torn at the neck, and she put a hand to the torn edge automatically, trying to fit it back in place. "Have you seen my bundle?" she said in an almost ordinary voice. "I have a housewife in it. Need a needle."
"I'll look for it," Rachel said soothingly.
"Did thee drop it in the wood?" "Sir?" Fanny spoke quite sharply behind William, and he became aware that she'd been there for a few moments. She'd said it once or twice before.
"What?"
he said impatiently, half turning toward her while trying to keep both Jane and Rachel in view. "There's an Indian in there," she said, and pointed toward the woods. "Ian!" Rachel ran across the road, fleet as a snipe, and vanished into the trees. William followed hastily, hand on his knife. There was likely more than one Indian in these woods, and if it wasn't Murray. But he could tell from Rachel's exclamation of mingled horror and relief from the depths of the wood that it was.
Murray was crumpled into a heap in the deep shadow at the base of a big pine tree. Needles half scuffled over him. Evidently, he'd tried to disguise himself, but had passed out before managing the job.
"He's breathing," Rachel said, and he heard the catch in her voice.
"Good," William said briefly, and, squatting beside her, put a hand on Murray's shoulder to turn him over. The apparently insensible body gave a shriek, contorted violently, and ended on his knees, swaying and glaring wildly round, clutching the shoulder William had seized. Only then did William see the dried blood streak down the arm, and the fresh dribbles running down from the broken shaft of an arrow embedded in the swollen flesh.
"Ian,"
Rachel said.
"Ian, it's me. It's all right now. I have thee."
Her voice was steady, but her hand trembled as she touched him. Murray gulped air, and his bleared gaze seemed to clear, travelling from Fanny and Jane, who had come into the grove after William, pausing briefly with a frown at William's face, then settling and easing as he saw Rachel. He closed his eyes and let out a long breath.
"Tank do ya,"
he said, and sank back on his haunches.
"Water,"
Rachel said urgently, shaking the empty canteen that lay on the ground beside Ian.
"Has he got any water, William?"
"I have," said Jane, stirring out of her trance and groping for the canteen round her neck.
"Will he be all right, do you think?"
Rachel didn't answer, but helped Murray to drink, her face pale with anxiety. Murray's own face bore the remnants of war paint, William saw with interest, and a brief ripple raised the hairs on his scalp, wondering whether Murray had killed any of the British soldiers. At least the bugger wasn't sporting any scalps on his belt, British or otherwise. Rachel was conversing now in low tones with Murray, glancing now and then at William, a certain speculation in her gaze. William was mildly surprised to find that he knew exactly what she was thinking, though perhaps it wasn't so surprising. He'd been wondering much the same thing. Could Murray ride the mule? Plainly he couldn't walk far. And if he couldn't, could Rachel persuade William to take Murray and her into the city in the wagon? He felt his stomach clench at the thought of going back to Philadelphia. His own gaze flicked toward Jane, only to discover that she wasn't there. Neither was Fanny. He was halfway to his feet when he heard Rachel's mule bray in protest, and he made it to the road in seconds to find Jane engaged in a futile struggle to push Fanny up into the saddle. The younger girl was trying valiantly, clutching at the mule's bristly mane and attempting to get a leg up, but the mule was objecting strenuously to this sort of interference, tossing his head and backing away from Jane, leaving Fanny's legs kicking desperately in the air. William reached her in three paces and clasped her about the waist. "Let go, sweetheart," he said calmly. "I've got you." Fanny was surprisingly solid, given her fragile appearance. She smelled sweet, too, though her neck was grubby and her clothes grimed with mud and road dust. He put her down and turned a firm eye on Jane, who was looking defiant. He'd been acquainted with her long enough now, though, to see that the uplifted chin and tight jaw were covering fear, and in consequence spoke more gently than he might have. "Where were you planning to go?" he asked, in a tone of mild interest.
"Well, New York,"
she answered, but uncertainly, and her eyes were darting to and fro, as though expecting some threat to manifest itself from the peaceful countryside.
"Without me? I'm hurt, madam, that you should have conceived a sudden dislike of my company. What have I done to offend you, pray?"
She pressed her lips tight together, but he could see that his jesting tone had settled her a little. She was still red in the face from exertion, but not breathing in that jerky way.
"I think we must part, Lord Ellesmere," she said, with a touchingly absurd attempt at formality. "We shall make our own way now."
He folded his arms, leaned back against the wagon, and looked down his nose at her.
"How?" he inquired. "You haven't any money, you don't have a mount, and you wouldn't get 5 miles on foot without running into someone else like those German fellows."
"I have a little money."
She smoothed the hand over her skirt, and he saw that there was indeed a bulge where her pocket lay. Despite his intent to remain calm, there was still a spring of anger in him, and it burst forth at this.
"Where did you get it?" he demanded, straightening up and grabbing her by the wrist. "Did I not forbid you to whore?"
She yanked her hand smartly free and took 2 quick steps back.
"You haven't any right to forbid me to do any damn thing I want," she snapped, colour burning high in her cheeks. "And it's none of your business, but I didn't make this money on my back."
"What then? Pimping your sister?"
She slapped him hard. He shouldn't have said it, and knew it, but the knowledge and his stinging cheek only made him angrier.
"I should bloody leave you here, you..."
"Good. That's just what I want you to do. You...
Before either of them could decide upon an epithet, Rachel and Ian emerged from the wood, the tall Scot leaning heavily on her. William gave Jane a final glare and went to help, taking Murray's weight on one side. The man stiffened, resisting for a moment, but then yielded. He had to.
"What happened?" William asked, nodding at the broken arrow shaft. "A private quarrel, or just bad aim?"
That made Murray's mouth twitch, reluctantly.
"Fortunes of war," he said hoarsely,
and sat down on the open tailboard of the wagon. He was breathing like a winded ox, but had possession of himself. He gave William a brief glance.
"What are you doing here, Sassenach?"
"None of your business, but a good job I was," William replied, just as briefly.
He turned to Rachel, having made up his mind on the moment.
"Take the wagon and see the girls somewhere safe."
"That..."
Rachel began, but then looked round, startled, as Jane and Fanny ran past her, across the road and dived into the wood.
"Where are they going?"
"Oh, bloody hell,"
William said, already striding across the road.
"Wait here."
They couldn't outrun him, and they had nothing in the way of woodcraft that would enable them to lie hidden. He caught Fanny, again the slower of the two, by the back of her pinafore as she was scrambling over a log. To his astonishment, she squirmed round in his grasp and launched herself at him, scratching at his face and screaming,
"One, Janie, one!"
"Will you bloody stop that?" he said crossly, holding her at arm's length.
"How?"
For she had sunk her teeth into his wrist, and he dropped her. She eeled over the log and bounded away like a rabbit, still screaming her head off. He started to follow her, and then thought better. On the one hand, he had a strong impulse to abandon them, but on the other, he remembered Mac telling him about plovers one day as they sat near Wattenlough Tarn, eating bread and cheese, watching the birds.
"Bugger off, Mac,"
he said under his breath, and shoved thought of both Hellwater and the groom ruthlessly away, but remembered, whether he wanted to or not.
"They run about and call out as though wounded, see?"
Mac's arm had been round him, keeping him from going too close to the fluttering bird. "But it's to draw ye away from their nest, lest ye crush the eggs or damage the young.
Look canny, though, and you'll see them."
William stood quite still, calming his own breath, and looking round, slow and careful, barely moving his head. And there indeed was the plover's nest. Alas for Jane, she had worn her pink calico today, and her rosy buttocks rounded smoothly up out of the grass 10 feet away, quite like a pair of eggs in a nest at that. He walked quietly, without haste. Nobly resisting the strong urge to smack her beguilingly curved behind, he instead laid a hand flat on her back.
"Tag," he said, "you're it."
She wriggled out from under his hand and shot up onto her feet.
"What?" she said. "What the bloody hell do you mean?"
She was wild-eyed and nervy, but cross as well.
"You've never played tag?" he asked, feeling foolish even as he said it.
"Oh," she said, and let out her breath a little. "It's a game, I see."
"Yes, but not for a long time."
He supposed one didn't play tag in a brothel.
"Look," she said tersely, "we want to go. I appreciate what you've done for me, for us, but..."
"Sit down," he said, and compelled her to do so, leading her to the log over which her sister had escaped, and pressing on her shoulder until she reluctantly sat. He then sat down beside her and took her hand in his. It was very small, cold and damp from the grass where she'd hidden.
"Look," he said firmly, but not, he hoped, unkindly. "I'm not letting you run off. That's flat. If you want to go to New York with the army, I'll take you. I've already said so. If you want to return to Philadelphia..."
"No!"
Her terror at the thought was clear now. She pulled desperately at her hand, but he wouldn't let go.
"Is it because of Captain Harkness? Because..."
She gave a cry that might have come from the throat of a wild bird caught in a trap, and he tightened his grip on her wrist. It was fine-boned and slender, but she was surprisingly strong.
"I know you stole the gorget back," he said. "It's all right. No one's going to find out. And Harkness won't touch you again, I promise you that."
She made a small bubbling noise that might have been a laugh or a sob.
"Colonel Tarleton, you know the Green Dragoon that made advances to you? He told me that Harkness was absent without leave, hasn't come back to his regiment. Do you know anything about that?"
"No," she said. "Let me go, please."
Before he could answer this, a small, clear voice piped up from the trees a few yards away.
"You'd best tell him, Janie."
"Fanny."
Jane swung round toward her sister, momentarily forgetting that she was pinioned.
"Don't."
Fanny stepped out of the shadows, wary but curiously composed.
"If you don't, I live," she said,
her big brown eyes fixed on William's face.
"You won't stop."
She came a little closer, cautious but not afraid.
"If I tell you," she said, "do you promise not to take us back?"
"Back where?"
"To Philadelphia," she said. "Or the army."
He sighed, exasperated, but short of torturing the answer out of one of the girls, clearly no progress would be made unless he agreed. And he was beginning to have a cold feeling under the ribs about just what the answer might be.
"I promise," he said.
But Fanny hung back, distrustful.
"Where?"
she said, folding her arms.
"So..."
"Oh, bloody hell. All right, then. I swear on my honour."
Jane made a small, dreary noise that was still a laugh. That stung.
"Do you think I haven't got any?" he demanded, turning on her.
"How would I know?" she countered, sticking out her chin. It wobbled, but she stuck it out.
"What does honour look like?"
"For your sake, you'd better hope it looks a lot like me," he told her,
but then turned to Fanny.
"What do you want me to swear on?"
"Your mother's head,"
she said promptly.
"My mother's dead."
"Your father, then?"
He drew a long, deep breath.
"Which one?" "I swear on my father's head," he said evenly.
And so they told him. "I knew he'd come back," Jane said. She was sitting on the log, hands clasped between her thighs and eyes on her feet.
"They always do, the bad ones."
She spoke with a sort of dull resignation, but her lips tightened at the memory.
"I can't stand to think you've got away without. I thought it would be me, though."
Fanny was sitting beside her sister, as close as she could get, and now she put her arms around Jane and hugged her, her face in Jane's calico shoulder.
"I'm sorry,"
she whispered,
I know, lovely, Jane said, and patted Fanny's leg.
A fierce look came into her face, though.
It's not your fault. And don't ever, ever think so.
William's throat felt thick with disgust at the thought. That beautiful, flower-faced little girl taken by...
Her maidenhead's worth £10, Jane reminded him. Mrs. Abbott was saving her, waiting for a rich man with a taste for new-hatched chicks. Captain Harkness offered her 20.
She looked directly at William for the first time.
I wasn't having that, she said simply, so I asked Mrs. Abbott to send us up together. I said I could help keep Fanny from making a fuss.
I knew what he was like, see? She said, and pressed her lips involuntarily together for an instant.
He wasn't the sort to plough you like a bull and have it done. He'd play with you, making you undress a bit at a time, and do things, while he told you all about what he meant to do.
And so it had been easy to come behind him while he was watching Fanny, with the knife she'd taken from the kitchen hidden in the folds of her petticoats.
I meant to stab him in the back, she said, looking down again. I saw a man stabbed that way once. But he saw on Fanny's face what I... Well, it wasn't her fault. She couldn't help it showing, she added quickly. But he turned round quick and there wasn't any choice.
She'd plunged the knife into Harkness's throat and wrenched it free, intending to stab again. But that hadn't been necessary.
There was blood everywhere.
She had gone pale in the telling, her hands wrapped in her apron.
I threw up, Fanny added matter-of-factly. It was a mess.
I expect it was, William said dryly.
He was trying not to envision the scene. The candlelight, the spraying blood, the panicked girls, with remarkably little success.
How did you get away?
Jane shrugged. It was my room. And he'd bolted the door. And nobody was surprised when Fanny started screaming, she added, with a trace of bitterness.
There was a basin and pitcher of water, the usual rags for mess. They'd washed themselves hastily, changed clothes, and climbed out the window.
We found a ride on a farmer's wagon and... you know the rest.
She closed her eyes for a moment, as though reliving the rest, and then opened them, and looked up at him, her gaze dark as shadowed water.
"Now what?" she asked.
William had been asking himself that question for the last several moments of Jane's story. Having met Harkness himself, he had considerable sympathy for Jane's action, but...
"You planned it," he said, giving her a sharp look.
Her head was bent, her unbound hair hiding her face.
You took the knife. You had clothes to change into. You knew how to get down from the window and get away.
So?
Said Fanny in a remarkably cold voice for a girl of her age.
So why kill him?
He asked, transferring his attention to Fanny, but keeping a wary eye on Jane.
You were going to leave anyway. Why not just escape before he came?
Jane raised her head and turned it, looking him directly in the eye.
"I wanted to kill him," she said,
in a perfectly reasonable voice that chilled him despite the warmth of the day.
"I see."
He saw more than the vision of Jane with her delicate white wrists plunging a knife into Captain Harkness's thick red throat while her little sister screamed. He saw Rachel's face pale among the leaves 6 feet away. From her expression, it was apparent that she had heard everything. He cleared his throat.
"Is, Mr. Murray all right?" he asked politely.
Jane and Fanny whirled wide-eyed.
"He fainted," Rachel replied.
She was eyeing the younger girls in much the same way that they were looking at her, with a gaze of fascinated horror.
"His shoulder is badly inflamed. I came to see if they had any brandy."
He fumbled in his pocket and withdrew a small silver flask with the Gray family arms engraved upon it.
"Whiskey do for you?"
he asked, handing it over.
Rachel looked surprised. Whiskey wasn't a popular drink, but Lord John had always had a taste for it, and William had taken to it himself. Though now, knowing the truth about his disgraceful taint of Scottish blood, he wasn't sure he'd ever be able to drink the stuff again.
"It will, I thank thee."
She stood, holding it for a moment, clearly wanting to go to Murray, but also hesitant to leave. He felt rather grateful to her for that hesitancy. He would as soon not be alone with Jane and Fanny, or rather, he didn't want to be alone with the decision as to what the devil to do about them. Rachel appeared to correctly interpret this feeling, for with a brief, "I'll bring it right back," she disappeared in the direction of the road. No one spoke. After that one direct look, Jane had bent her head again and sat quietly, though one hand restlessly smoothed the fabric of her skirt across one round thigh, over and over. Fanny ran a hand over the crown of Jane's head in a protective gesture, while staring at William with a complete lack of expression. He found it unnerving. What was he to do with them? Of course they couldn't go back to Philadelphia, and he dismissed as unworthy the impulse simply to abandon them to their own devices, but... "Why not go to New York with the army?" he asked, his voice seeming unnaturally loud, harsh to his own ears. "What made you run yesterday?"
"Oh."
Jane looked up slowly, her eyes a little unfocused, as though she had been dreaming.
"I saw him again. The Green Dragoon. He'd wanted me to go with him the night before, and I wouldn't. But I saw him again yesterday morning and thought he was looking for me."
She swallowed.
"I told you. I know the ones who don't give up."
"Very perceptive of you," he said, eyeing her with some respect. "He doesn't." "You misliked him on sight, then?" Because he didn't think for an instant that his having forbidden her to ply her trade would have stopped her, had she wanted to.
"It wasn't that," she said,
and flicked Bannister Tarleton away with the sort of abrupt gesture one uses to shoo insects.
"But he'd come to the brothel before, last year. He didn't go with me then. He chose another girl. But I knew if he spent much time with me, he'd likely remember why I seemed familiar to him. He said I did," she added, "when he came up to me in the bread line."
"I see."
He paused.
"So you did want to go to New York, but not with the army, is that right?"
Jane shrugged, angry. "Does it matter?"
"Why the devil shouldn't it matter?"
"When has it ever mattered what a whore wants?"
She sprang up and stamped across the clearing, leaving him staring after her in astonishment. "What's wrong with her?" he demanded, turning to Fanny. The younger girl eyed him dubiously, lips pressed together, but then gave a little shrug.
"She thinks you might give her to a constable or magistrate," she said, struggling a bit with magistrate. "Or maybe to the army. It was a soldier she killed."
William rubbed a hand over his face. In fact, the thought of delivering Jane to justice had flitted through his mind, in the wake of the shock of learning of her crime. The thought hadn't outlasted its birth, though. "I wouldn't do that," he said to Fanny, striving to sound reasonable. She looked at him skeptically, under level, dark brows.
"Why wouldn't you?"
"Excellent question," he said dryly, "and I haven't got an answer. But I suppose I don't need one." He lifted a brow at her, and she gave a small snort of a laugh. Jane was edging along the far side of the clearing, glancing back toward Fanny every few seconds. Her intent was clear, but she wouldn't go without her sister. He was sure of that much. "Since you're here with me," he observed, "and not over there with your sister, you don't want to run, and you know she won't go without you. Ergo, I conclude that you don't think I'd give her up to justice." She shook her head, slow and solemn as an owl.
"Jane says I don't know anything about men yet,
But I do.
He sighed.
God help me, Francis. You do.
There was no further conversation until Rachel returned a few minutes later.
I can't lift him, she said directly to William, ignoring the girls for the moment. Will he help me?
He rose at once, relieved by the prospect of physical action, but glanced over his shoulder at Jane, still hovering by the far side of the clearing, like a hummingbird.
We'll be here,
Fanny said quietly. He gave her a nod and went. He found Murray lying by the side of the road near the wagon. The man wasn't unconscious, but the influence of the fever upon him was clear. His gaze was bleared and his speech slurring.
I can walk. Like hell you can, William said briefly. Hold on to my arm.
He got the man sitting upright and had a look for himself at the wounded shoulder. The wound itself wasn't that bad. It was apparent no bones were broken, and it hadn't bled a lot. On the other hand, the flesh was red and swollen, and starting to suppurate. He leaned close and took an unobtrusive sniff. Not unobtrusive enough. Rachel noticed.
There's no gangrene, she said. I think there will not. I think things will be well, so long as we can get into a doctor soon.
What does he mean to do about thy girls? She added abruptly.
He didn't bother telling her again that they weren't his. Evidently they were, at least in terms of immediate responsibilities. I don't know, he admitted, rising to his feet. He glanced into the woods, but the clearing was far enough in that there was no flicker of garment or movement visible. They can't go to Philadelphia, and I can't take them back to the army. The best I can think of just now is to find them some place of refuge in one of the little villages hereabouts, and cache them there until I can make some provision to get them to some place safer.
Wherever the hell that might be.
Canada? He wondered wildly. Rachel shook her head decidedly.
Thee has no notion how people talk in small places, or how quickly news and rumour spread.
She glanced down at Murray, who was still sitting upright, but swaying, his eyes half closed.
They have no other profession, she said, and it would be quickly apparent to anyone what that profession is.
They require not only refuge, but refuge with people who will not cast them out once that becomes known. She was brown with the sun. Her blue calico bonnet had fallen off in the struggle with Jane and hung back over her shoulders. But her face paled when she looked at Murray. She clenched her fists, closed her eyes for an instant, then opened them, straightening to her full height, and looked William in the eye.
There is a small settlement of Friends, perhaps 2 hours' travel from here. No more than 3 or 4 farms. I know of it from one of the women who came to Valley Forge with her husband. The girls could be kept safe there for a while at least.
No,
Murray said.
It canna be.
He paused, eyes going out of focus, and braced himself on his sound arm, still swaying. He swallowed thickly.
No, he repeated. Not safe.
It isn't, William agreed. 3 young women on the road alone, and without even a pistol to defend yourselves.
If I had a pistol, I would not use it, Rachel pointed out with some asperity. Nor a cannon, come to that.
Murray laughed, or at least made a noise that might pass for amusement.
Aye,
he managed, and stopped to breathe before getting the next words out.
You take them, he said to William. I'll do here fine.
Thee bloody won't, Rachel said fiercely.
She grabbed William's arm and pulled him closer to Murray.
Look at him. Tell him. Since he professes not to believe me.
William looked, reluctantly, glancing at Murray's face, pale as suet and slick with an unhealthy sweat. Flies clustered thick on Murray's shoulder. He lacked the strength to brush them away.
Merde,
William muttered under his breath. Then louder, though still with reluctance.
She's right. You need a doctor, if you're to have a chance of keeping your arm. That thought evidently hadn't struck Murray. Death, yes. Amputation, no.
He turned his head and frowned at the wound.
Bloody hell, William said, and turned to Rachel. All right, he said. Tell me where this settlement is. I'll take them.
She grimaced, fists balling up at her sides. Even friends may not take well to the sudden appearance of a stranger who asked them to give indefinite sanctuary to a murderess. I am not a stranger, and can plead the girl's case better than thee can.
She drew a breath that swelled her bosom noticeably, and looked at Murray, then turned her head to give William a piercing look.
If I do this, thee must see him safe.
I must?
Rachel,
Murray said hoarsely, but she ignored him.
Yes, we'll have to take the wagon, the girls and I.
William drew a breath of his own, but he could see that she was right. He could also see just what the decision to save Jane was costing her.
All right, he said tersely.
He reached up and took the gorget from his neck and handed it to her.
Give Jane this. She may need it if they find themselves on their own.
Oddly, the removal of the gorget seemed a weight off his mind as well.
Even the possibility of being arrested if anyone in Philadelphia recognized him didn't trouble him over much.
He was about to remove his incriminating coat and waistcoat, he'd have to hide those somewhere, when Rachel stepped close to him and laid a hand on his arm.
This man is my heart and my soul, she said simply, looking up into his face. And he is thy own blood, whatever thee may presently feel about the fact. I trust thee to see him safe, for all our sakes.
William gave her a long look, thought of several possible replies, and made none of them, but gave a curt nod.
Where should I take him? He asked. To Lady J? I mean, to Mrs. F? I mean, God damn it, he amended, feeling the blood rise in his cheeks. To his aunt?
Rachel looked at him, startled.
He doesn't know. Of course he doesn't. How could he?
She waved off her own denseness, impatient.
His aunt was shot in the course of the battle outside Tennant Church, where she was tending the wounded.
William's annoyance was doused at once, as though ice water had been poured on his head, flooding his veins.
Is she dead?
By the grace of our Lord, no, she said, and he felt the tightness in his chest relax a little. Or at least she wasn't yesterday, she amended with a frown. Though very badly hurt,
the tightness returned.
She's in the Macken house in the village of Freehold, about 6 miles in that direction.
She nodded down the road. My brother is likely there as well, or nearby. There are still wounded from the battle there.
He can deal with Ian's wound.
For the first time, her voice lost its steadiness as her eyes went to her betrothed. Murray's eyes were sunken and glazed with fever, but he had sufficient command of himself to reach out his good hand to her. The movement put weight on the bad arm, and he grimaced. But Rachel was kneeling beside him in an instant, arms around him. William coughed and turned discreetly away to leave them a moment's privacy in which to make their farewells. Whatever his own feelings, they deserved that. He'd seen many wounds go bad, and reckoned Murray's chances as no better than even. On the other hand, the man was apparently both a bloody Scot and a Mohawk, and both races were notoriously hard to kill. He had walked away from the road, and his eye now caught the flutter of pink fabric behind a bush. Jane, he called, is that you?
Yes, she said.
She stepped out into the open, folded her arms, and pointed her chin at him.
What do you mean to do? With me, I mean.
Miss Hunter is going to take you and Fanny to a safe place, he said, as gently as he could.
In spite of her brave facade, she reminded him of a fawn, dappled light coming through the trees, mottling her face and gown, making her seem shy and insubstantial, as though she might fade into the forest in the next breath.
I'll send word to you there when I've made some suitable arrangements.
Her?
James shot a surprised glance toward the road.
Why? Why can't you take us?
Doesn't she want to stay with her...
the Indian?
Miss Hunter will have time to explain everything to you on the way.
He hesitated, unsure what else to say to her. From the road, he heard the distant murmur of voices. Rachel and Ian Murray. He couldn't make out the words, but it didn't matter. What they were saying to each other was plain.
He felt a small, sharp pain under his third waistcoat button and coughed, trying to dislodge it.
Thank you, sir,
said a soft voice behind him, and he turned to find Fanny at his elbow. She took his hand, turned it palm upward, and planted a small, warm kiss in the centre.
You're most welcome, Miss Fanny, he said, smiling at her, in spite of everything.
She nodded to him, very dignified, and walked out to the road, leaving him with Jane. For a moment they stood staring at each other.
I offered you a lot more than a kiss, she said quietly. You didn't want it. I haven't got anything else to give you in thanks.
Jane, he said, it's not... I didn't.
And then stopped, desperately sorry, but helpless to think of anything he could possibly say in reply.
Safe travels, Jane, he said at last, his throat tight. Goodbye.
Chapter 90. It's a wise child who knows his father. It was apparent that while sound, Rachel's mule wasn't up to the weight of two men the size of William and Ian Murray. No matter, they couldn't go any faster than a walk in any case. Murray could ride and William would walk alongside to make sure the bastard didn't fall off. Murray managed to get up into the saddle, in spite of having only one functional hand. Rachel had roughly bandaged his wounded arm and put it into a sling torn from her underpetticoat. William didn't offer him assistance, feeling reasonably sure that such an offer would be neither welcomed nor accepted. Watching the laborious process, though, William was interested to note that while the fabric of the sling was much laundered and faded, it had been embroidered with small blue and yellow sunbursts along one edge. Did Quaker women commonly wear attractive undergarments beneath their sober gowns? As they set off at a cautious walk, the sound of the wagon was still audible, though fading into the rush of trees.
"Are you armed?"
Murray asked suddenly.
"Slightly."
He still had the knife Jane had pushed into his hand, now wrapped in a handkerchief and tucked in his pocket, as he had no sheath for it. He fingered the wooden handle, wondering whether it was the same knife that she... Well, of course it was.
"I'm not. Will you find me a club?"
"You don't trust me to see you safe," William asked sarcastically.
Murray's shoulders were slumped, and his head thrust forward, nodding a little with the mule's gait. But he turned and gave William a look that was heavy-eyed with fever, but still surprisingly alert.
"Oh, I trust ye fine. It's men like the ones you just fought I dinna trust."
This was a fair point. The roads were far from safe, and the knowledge gave William a severe pang of conscience on behalf of the women he'd just dispatched, unarmed and unprotected, to drive miles over those very roads with a valuable mule and cart.
"I should have gone with them, insisted we all go together. My ma'am always says there's no one more stubborn than my Uncle Jimmy," Murray observed mildly. "But a Quaker lass wi' her mind made up could give Uncle Jimmy a run for his money, I'll tell you. I couldna have stopped her, and neither could you."
William wasn't in a mood to discuss any of the persons mentioned, nor yet engage in philosophical discussions of relative stubbornness. He put a hand on the bridle and pulled the mule to a halt.
"Stay here. I see something that might do."
He'd already seen that there was little in the way of fallen branches near the road,
there never was, when an army's foragers had recently passed through. But he saw an orchard of some kind, a little way from the road, with a farmhouse beyond. As he made his way toward the orchard, he could see that artillery had been hauled through it. There were deep furrows in the ground, and many of the trees had broken limbs, hanging like jackstraws. There was a dead man in the orchard, American militia by his hunting shirt and homespun breeches, lying curled among the gnarled roots of a big apple tree.
"Should have culled that one," William said aloud, keeping his voice steady.
"Old apple trees never yielded much. You took them out after 15-20 years and replanted." He turned away from the body, but not fast enough to avoid seeing the greedy flies rise up in a buzzing cloud from what was left of the face. He walked 3 paces away and threw up. No doubt it was the cloying smell of rotting apples that rose above the ghost of black powder. The whole orchard hummed with the noise of wasps gorging themselves on the juices. He unwrapped the handkerchief from Jane's knife and thrust the knife through his belt, without looking to see if there were bloodstains on it. He wiped his mouth, then, after a moment's hesitation, went and laid the handkerchief over the rebel's face. Someone had stripped the body. He had neither weapons nor shoes.
"This do you?"
He laid a 3-foot length of apple wood across the saddle bow. He'd broken it at both ends, so it made a serviceable club about the thickness of his own forearm. Murray seemed to wake from a doze. He drew himself slowly upright, took hold of the club, and nodded.
"Aye, that'll do,"
he said softly. His voice sounded thick, and William looked at him sharply.
"You'd best drink some more," he said, handing up the canteen again. It was getting low, probably no more than a quarter full. Murray took it, though moving sluggishly, drank, and gave it back with a sigh.
They walked without conversation for a half hour or so, leaving William time at last to sort through the events of the morning. It was well past noon now. The sun was pressing on his shoulders like a heated flat iron. How far did Rachel say it was to Freehold? 6 miles?
"Do you want me to tell you, or no?"
Murray said suddenly.
"Tell me what?"
There was a brief sound that might have been either amusement or pain.
"Whether you're much like him?"
Possible responses to this came so fast that they collapsed upon themselves like a house of cards. He took the one on top.
"Why do you suppose I should wonder?"
William managed with a coldness that would have frozen most men. Of course, Murray was blazing with such a fever it would take a Quebec blizzard to freeze him.
"I would, if it was me,"
Murray said mildly. That diffused William's incipient explosion momentarily.
"Perhaps you think so," he said, not trying to hide his annoyance. "You may know him, but you know nothing whatever about me."
This time the sound was undeniably amusement, laughter, of a hoarse creaking sort.
"I helped fish you out of a privy 10 years ago, Murray said. "That was when I first kent it, aye?"
Shock struck William almost dumb, but not quite.
"What, that place in the mountains? Fraser's Ridge?"
He'd succeeded for the most part in forgetting the incident of the snake in the privy, and with it, most of a miserable journey through the mountains of North Carolina. Murray took William's collar for confusion, though, and chose to elucidate.
"The way you came out of the muck, your eyes blazing blue and your face set for murder, that was Uncle Jamie to the life when he's roused."
Murray's head bobbed forward alarmingly. He caught himself and straightened up with a muffled groan.
"If you're going to fall off," William said with elaborate courtesy, "do it on the other side, will you?"
"Mm-hmm." They paced another 100 yards before Murray came to life again, resuming the conversation, if it could be called that, as though there had been no pause.
"So when I found you in the swamp, I kent who you were. I didn't recall you thanking me for saving your life that time, by the way. You can thank me for not strapping you into a travois with a dead panther and dragging you for miles through the dirt now," William snapped.
Murray laughed, gasping a little.
"You'd likely do it if you had a dead panther."
The effort of laughing seemed to deprive him of balance, and he swayed alarmingly.
"Fall off, and I'll do it anyway," William said, grabbing him by the thigh to steady him. "Dead panther or not." Christ, the man's skin was so hot he could feel it through the buckskin leggings.
Despite his fog, Murray noticed his reaction.
"You lived through the fever," he said, and took a deep breath. "I will, too. Dunna fash."
"If by that expression you mean that I ought not to be concerned that you'll die," William said coldly, "I'm not."
"I'm no worried either,"
Murray assured him. The man wobbled slightly, reins held loose in one hand, and William wondered if he could be sunstruck.
"You promised Rachel, I?"
"Yes," William said, adding almost involuntarily,
"I owe her and her brother my life, as much as I do you."
"Mm-hmm," Murray said agreeably, and fell silent. He seemed to be going a nasty greyish colour under the sun-brown skin. This time he stayed silent for a good 5 minutes before coming suddenly to life again.
"And you dinna think I ken much about you, after listening to you rave with fever for days?"
"I do not," William said. "No more than I think I'll know a great deal about you by the time I get you to Freehold."
"Maybe more than you think. Stop, I'm going to puke."
"Whoa!"
The mule obligingly halted, though it clearly didn't like either the sound or the smell of what was going on behind its head, and kept sidling round in circles, trying to escape it. William waited till it was over, then handed up his canteen without comment. Murray drained it and handed it back. His hand was shaking, and William began to be worried.
"We'll stop as soon as I find water," he said. "Get you into the shade."
Neither of them had a hat. He'd left his in the copse, rolled up with his uniform coat under a bush. Murray didn't reply to this. He wasn't precisely raving, but seemed to be pursuing a separate conversation in his head.
"I maybe dinna ken you that well, but Rachel does."
That was undeniably true and gave William an oddly mixed sense of shame, pride and anger. Rachel and her brother did know him well. They'd saved his life and nursed him back to health, had travelled with him for weeks and shared both food and danger.
"She says you're a good man."
William's heart squeezed a little.
"I'm obliged for her good opinion," he said.
The water hadn't helped that much. Murray was definitely swaying in the saddle, his eyes half closed.
"If you die," William said loudly, "I'll marry her."
That worked. Murray's eyelids lifted at once. He smiled, very slightly.
"Ken that," he said. "Ken I'm no going to die. And besides, he owe me a life, Englishman."
"I don't. I saved your bloody life, too. I saved the both of you from that maniac, Bug, was he, with the axe in Philadelphia. We're quits."
Some interminable time later, Murray roused himself again.
"I doubt it," he said.
Chapter 91. Keeping Score. Jamie saw the Greys out of the house and came back with an air of grim satisfaction. I would have laughed if it hadn't hurt to do it, but settled for smiling at him.
"Your son? Your nephew? Your wife?" I said. "Fraser 3, Grey 0.
He gave me a startled look, but then his face truly relaxed for the first time in days.
"You're feeling better then," he said,
and coming across the room, bent and kissed me.
"Talk daft to me some more, eh?"
He sat down heavily on the stool and sighed, but with relief.
"Mind," he said, "I have neither the slightest idea how I'm going to keep you with no money, no commission, and no profession. But keep ye, I will."
"No profession, forsooth," I said comfortably. "Name one thing you can't do."
"Sing."
"Oh, well, besides that."
He spread his hands on his knees, looking critically at the scars on his maimed right hand.
"I doubt I could make a living as a juggler or a pickpocket either, let alone a scribe."
"You haven't got to write," I said. "You have a printing press. Bonnie by name."
"Well,
he admitted, a certain light coming into his eyes.
"I do.
but she's in Wilmington at the moment. His press had been shipped from Edinburgh in care of Richard Bell, who was, presumably, keeping her in trust until her real owner should come to repossess her.
We'll go and get her, and then...
But I stopped, afraid to jinx the future by planning too far. It was an uncertain time for everyone, and no telling what the morrow might bring. But first, I amended, reaching out to squeeze his hand, you should rest. You look as though you're about to die.
Dinna talk that sort of daft, he said,
and laughed and yawned simultaneously, nearly breaking his jaw.
Lie down, I said firmly. Sleep,
at least until Lieutenant Bixby shows up again with more cheese. The American army had withdrawn to English Town, some 7 miles away, only an hour's ride. The British army had decamped entirely, but as many of the militia units' enlistments had expired soon afterwards, the roads were still very busy with men going home, mostly afoot. He did lie down on his pallet, with surprisingly little protest, a good indication of just how exhausted he really was, and was asleep in seconds. I was very tired myself, still very weak and easily exhausted, even by something like the Grey's visit, and I lay back and dozed, stirring to wakefulness every so often when some sound roused me. But Jamie slept deeply, and it eased my heart to hear his soft, regular snore. I woke some time later, hearing a distant knocking below. As I raised my head blearily off the pillow, I heard a voice shouting, "Hello, the house!" and snapped into instant alertness. I knew that voice. I glanced quickly down, but Jamie was dead asleep, curled up like a hedgehog. With excruciating slowness, I managed to swing my legs off the bed, and moving like a geriatric tortoise and clinging to the bed frame, took the 2 steps that brought me to the window, where I clung to the sill. There was a handsome bay mule in the dooryard, with a half-naked body laid over the saddle. I gasped, and immediately doubled in pain, but didn't let go the sill. I bit my lip hard, not to call out. The body was wearing buckskins, and his long brown hair sported a couple of bedraggled turkey feathers.
"Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I breathed through gritted teeth. "Please, God, don't let him be."
But the prayer was answered before I'd finished speaking it. The door below opened, and in the next moment, William and Lieutenant Macken walked out and lifted Ian off the mule, put his arms about their shoulders, and carried him into the house. I turned, instinctively reaching for my medical bag, and nearly fell. I saved myself by a grab at the bed frame, but let out an involuntary groan that brought Jamie up into a crouch, staring wildly about.
"It's all right," I said,
willing my belly muscles into immobility.
"I'm fine. It's Ian. He's come back."
Jamie sprang to his feet, shook his head to clear it, and at once went to the window. I saw him stiffen, and clutching my side, followed him. William had come out of the house and was preparing to mount the mule. He was dressed in shirt and breeches, very grubby, and the sun licked his dark chestnut hair with streaks of red. Mrs. Macken said something from the door, and he turned to answer her. I don't think I made a noise, but something made him look up suddenly, and he froze. I felt Jamie freeze too, as their eyes met. William's face didn't change, and after a long moment he turned to the mule again, mounted, and rode away. After another long moment, Jamie let out his breath.
"Let me put you back to bed, Sassenach," he said calmly. "I'll have to go and find Denny to put Ian right."
Chapter 92. I will not have thee be alone. Someone had given him laudanum before setting to work on his shoulder. Strange stuff, that. He'd had it before, he thought, a long time ago, though he hadn't known the name at the time. Now Ian lay on his back, blinking slowly as the drug ebbed from his mind, trying to decide where he was and what was real. He was pretty sure most of what he was looking at right now wasn't. Pain.
That was real, and something to use as an anchor. It hadn't entirely gone away. He'd been aware of it, but remotely, as a disagreeable, muddy green strand, like a stream of dirty water meandering through his dreams. Now that he was awake, though, it was becoming more disagreeable by the minute. His eyes didn't want to focus yet, but he forced them to roll about in search of something familiar. He found it at once.
Girl. Lass. Ethan, what was her...
Rachel, he croaked, and she rose instantly from what she was doing and came to him, her face worried but alight.
Rachel,
he said again, uncertain, and she took hold of his good hand, pressing it to her bosom.
Thee is awake, I see, she said softly, her eyes searching his face, but still much fevered from the heat of thy skin. How does thee feel?
Better for seeing ye, lass.
He tried to lick his dry lips.
Is there maybe water?
She made a small sound of distress that he'd had to ask, and hurried to bring a cup to his lips. It was perhaps the best thing he'd ever tasted, made better by her holding his head in her hand as he drank. He was very dizzy. He didn't want to stop, but she took the cup away.
More presently, she promised. Thee must not drink too much, too fast, or thee will vomit.
And between the dirt and the blood, thee has made enough mess already, she said, smiling.
Mm-hmm,
he said, lying back. He was mostly clean, he discovered. Someone had washed away the last of the deer fat and paint, and a good deal of sweat and blood with it. His shoulder was bound up with a poultice of some kind. It smelled tangy and familiar. But his hazy mind was a long way yet from allowing him to think of the name of the herb.
"Did Auntie Claire bind my arm?"
he asked. Rachel glanced at him, her brows furrowing.
"Thy aunt is ill," she said carefully. "Thee remembers I told thee that she was wounded, shot in the battle?"
"No,"
he said, feeling blank and confused. He had no recollection of the last couple of days or of the battle.
No. What? Is she all right, then?
Denny removed the ball, and thy Uncle Jamie is with her. Both of them say very firmly that she will be well.
Her mouth twitched a bit, halfway between a smile and worry. He did his best to smile back.
And she'll be fine, he said. Uncle Jamie's a very stubborn man. Can I have more water?
This time he drank more slowly, and got more down before she took it away. There was a regular clanging noise somewhere. For a time he'd taken it for some phantom of hearing left over from the dreams, but now it ceased for a moment, punctuated by a loud curse.
What? Where are we?
He asked, beginning to be able to look at things again. His wavering sight convinced him that he was indeed in a tiny cow byre. It was new hay he'd been smelling, and the warm scent of fresh cow dung. He was lying on a blanket spread over a mound of hay, but the cow was absent for the moment.
A place called Freehold. The battle was fought nearby. Washington and the army have withdrawn to Englishtown, but a good many wounded soldiers have been given refuge by the inhabitants here. We currently enjoy the hospitality of the local smith, a gentleman named Hewan.
Oh. The forge.
That was the source of the clanging and cursing. He closed his eyes. That helped with the dizziness. But he could see shadows of his dreams on the inside of his eyelids and opened them again.
Rachel was still there. That was good. Who won the battle?
He asked. She shrugged, impatient. So far as anyone has said